The Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Orthodox Nationalist. Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson is a former professor, a professional writer, and a priest of the Ukrainian Orthodox Church. His website is rusjournal.com. That's rusjournal.com. Now here's your host, Matt Johnson.
Okay, everybody, welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. Tonight I'm going to do something a little different. You know that on occasion I like to step away from my area of specialization and to deal with things that I'm competent to discuss, but not necessarily an expert on. And I was going through a lot of my old university lecture notes when I taught both at Nebraska and at Mount St. Mary's, and I came across a lecture that I particularly liked that I had put together years ago. And it was on General Francisco Franco, the Spanish Civil War, and Franco's rule in Spain after World War II. Now, Franco means a lot to me, and really only for one main reason, and that is that when I was a freshman in college, Francisco Franco was the first real nationalist figure that I read about and I came to admire. And so my interest in nationalism, social nationalism, monarchy, these kind of things really started 20 years ago when I first came across Stanley Payne's book on Franco. And so at Mount St. Mary's, I taught a 20th century history class fairly regularly, and of course Franco was a substantial part of that. And so I want to talk about General Franco today and really the Spanish economy under his rule. And the real purpose here is to lay out in some detail what in this case, a 20th century social nationalist, but certainly not national socialist, regime came into existence and how it operated. And so in dealing with Franco, I'm not claiming whatsoever to be an expert in Spanish history. However, I do claim to be an expert in nationalism, social nationalism, as a political philosophy, a way of thinking about politics and social life. And in this case, I'm just using General Franco and Spain in the 20th century as a foil, as a way to begin. Like a lot of these movements in the early 20th century, a lot of European states, number one, were struggling for their sense of identity. This is almost universal. And number two, really struggling with the advanced bourgeois capitalism that had taken over a good chunk of Western Europe. And in Spain, in the early part of the 20th century, life, I think, was generally very difficult. There was no real economic stability. The parliament, or Cortes, went back and forth in terms of its political composition and ideological composition. And you see this in France to some extent. You certainly see it in Weimar Germany. Party leaders come and go. Parliaments come and go. Elections come and go. Nothing ever gets done. And so country goes more and more into poverty, and making matters worse, a lot of these states start to see this very small upper class dominance of their life, and you have a few elites and a very large mass of more or less impoverished people. And when people like Primo de Rivera took over, his coup was in 1923, it occurred in one of these contexts that's actually very common in European and even Latin American life. You have a lot of strikes, you have a lot of labor unrest, you have a tremendous imbalance in wealth between the upper and lower middle and middle classes. And, of course, politicians and major political figures just come and go. But when Primo takes over and centralizes political power, economic growth takes off. And under de Rivera, the state was present as an economic actor in the sense, among other things, it was the arbitrator between the arbiter, I should say, between labor and management in terms of wages. De Rivera's rule in Spain was not a bad one. And here you had a fairly charismatic Roman Catholic ruler taking over from a decrepit parliamentary democracy. And with a certain tilt towards labor, wages went up as well as economic growth going up. The only problem was that in 1929 and then in 1930, the Great Depression had hit Spain. And in 1930, you had a terrible harvest in the Spanish countryside. And so de Rivera didn't last past this period of time. And another period of tremendous instability met, the Spanish people had to go through. So here you have a clear example of sort of the liberal democratic capitalist world not being able to be transplanted pretty much anywhere. The Spanish mentality did not accept it. Primo de Rivera was legitimately popular, tilted towards labor, and yet still saw fairly substantial economic growth throughout the 1920s. And of course, you know, in America, the economy was doing very well too prior to the crash. But the Great Depression and then the bad harvest in 1930 eventually destroyed that experiment in sort of a national syndicalism. Now, Francisco Franco is someone who always fascinated me because I he's this tiny little short tubby guy. They always made fun of him in the army. You know, he was always the butt of jokes. No one really thought that he was going to go anywhere militarily. And yet, of course, he becomes one of the most popular and beloved leaders in the 20th century, the Spanish-speaking world. But Franco was basically apolitical, but he did like the monarchy and he did like the church. And he worried quite a bit when the Spanish Republic was proclaimed in April of 1931. And 1 month later, May of 1931, the Marxists and some of these leftist anarchist groups, with government support, engaged in a reign of terror in the society, especially against the monastics in Spain. The Republicans had formed local militias armed by the state, and their purpose was to eliminate the Catholic religion from a Spanish life. And the result of this early 1930s violence, ideologically motivated violence in Spain, drove successful businessmen out of the country, and the purpose really was to prevent another de Rivera from removing the Republic and installing another a fairly popular nationalist state. And the leftist government, for all of their puerile rhetoric, never really helped the poor. The Spanish poor were very, very numerous. Thanks to the Depression and the violence of the leftist groups, paramilitary groups, destroyed the economy, destroyed any job-creating possibility in the country, and destroyed the morale of the country. In fact, labor demonstrated very much against the Spanish Republic. And so in 1933, a sort of a center-right group of parties won. There's a researcher by the name of Robert Royale who had estimated in really just a few years almost 7,000 Roman Catholic priests were murdered in Spain by the anarchists. The rightists lasted about 3 years, didn't do very much. In 1936, the so-called Popular Front government took over the parliament. They only got about 34.3% of the vote. And the Republic, once the Popular Front government was able to seize power in the parliament, the Spanish Republic declared itself a Marxist state, and their newspaper was put it this way. The Russian Pravda newspaper in this period of time explicitly called Spain an ally of the Soviet world and a Soviet socialist state. So there was absolutely no question as to the ideological leanings and support of the Republican government. And they sponsored the attacks on really any nationalist or Catholic or royalist movement in the country. And so you really have quite a bit of a parallel to what you have in America. You had two political factions, the center-right and the center-left, who did very, very little. They were simply grasping politicians. You had a revolutionary government that financed left-wing groups to destroy their opposition, no different than you have in America today, where the left is financed by the federal government as well as private sources in order to destroy their opposition in this country. And the opposition to the government was very muted. The church really was taken aback by all of this, and the wholesale murders of clergy, you know, reaching four and five figures, and of course, as far as the Western world was concerned, it was just one big collective yawn. They weren't particularly interested in this Holocaust. And it was a generally unpopular government with the mentality amongst the population that there's really nothing we can do about it. But General Franco, who was commissioned and had a command in Morocco, North Africa, was forced to invade the country to dislodge this regime. It was also sponsored, I want to make it clear, it was also sponsored by the Roosevelt family in America. The Archbishop of Guadalajara in Mexico had produced a personal check from Franklin Delano Roosevelt, a substantial check, especially for the time, sent to support the Republican cause and Republican movement in Spain. So they did receive aid from the United States, as the U.S. and the USSR were officially allies at the time, this period of time in the 1930s. The Republican government received aid both from the United States as well as from Joseph Stalin. And then as their final attack against the church, they banned all religious orders, the Dominicans, Franciscans, etc. The monarchist movement, I want to note, was relatively anti-German. And although the Germans did assist the nationalist movement, the Spanish government actually did owe quite a bit of money to Germany in the 1930s. And the war itself isn't a particular interest to me. I'm not a military historian, but as you know, Mussolini and Hitler had supported Franco. Franco was not particularly interested in Germany or in following the National Socialist movement. He was a social nationalist and a syndicalist and a royalist, but generally not supportive of the Third Reich. But he did accept aid from the German Air Force as well as the Italians, while the Republic was being supported by Stalin's Russia and to a lesser extent by the U.S. But when Franco finally takes over in 1939 and is able to unify the country around him, he kind of announces a social vision called national corporatism. And national corporatism was based around civic assemblies of occupational groups, sort of civic unions of different trade, of different trades and different trade organizations. And that these corporations would negotiate with capitalist enterprise And that's how they would make decisions in terms of wages and labor contracts and production goals, the treatment of labor, this sort of thing. And this, Franco believed, was part and parcel of the Roman Catholic economic view. I think to a great extent the Eastern Orthodox have somewhat of a similar economic view, and that this is certainly more moral than laissez-faire capitalism. And I want to say that the world that Franco created in 1939, especially after the war was over, and Franco had declared neutrality in World War II, with one exception, that he had sent the so-called Blue Division to fight alongside Hitler against Stalin. Other than that, Franco had declared neutrality in World War II, had rebuffed Hitler. Stanley Payne reports in his famous book on Franco that Hitler had negotiated with Franco to get him to join the war. And Franco, of course, having no interest in this, he only really was interested in rebuilding a war-torn Spain. He had no interest, and I'm not so sure he really had the political will, the political support to join the war. Had asked for all of North Africa in return, knowing full well that Hitler couldn't possibly give that to him. And of course, negotiations broke down. And Hitler was reported as saying that I'd rather have my teeth extracted than ever having to deal with Francisco Franco ever again. Although my personal opinion is that he probably respected Franco more than he did Mussolini. I never had, and I'm no Hitler expert, but I never had the impression that he particularly respected Mussolini at all. I never got that sense out of him. I think he respected the Croats. I think he respected the Slovenes. I think he respected the Japanese. I think he respected Franco, but that's probably it. He didn't like Franco, and after a while did not consider him an ally whatsoever. In fact, Franco permitted roughly 40,000 Jews to emigrate, or even to stay in Spain or go off to England or America. And really something that irritated Hitler, because these were Sephardic Jews in Romania and elsewhere in southeastern Europe, and he gave them Spanish citizenship. And in fact, there was the Jewish Committee was operating in Spain, which was generally an anti-Nazi organization, and Franco, of course, tolerated that. There's no evidence that Franco was anti-Jewish whatsoever. He was vehemently anti-Freemasonic. And Franco was convinced personally that the Republic, the Spanish Republic, was really very much a Masonic organization, that it was part of the European Illuminati, of the elite, found in such institutions as Freemasonry or the Royal Society or the Lunar Society of Great Britain. And in fact, Franco kept a fully stocked Masonic temple in the basement of his house to remind himself of the evils of Freemasonry. And of course, the Masonic movement, as well as the Marxist and anarchist groups in Spain, were banned. And once World War II was over, he wasn't liked in the Western world, but they knew that he was fairly popular. They were not going to remove him. And since he didn't directly fight for Hitler in any way, they really didn't have anything on him. And once FDR died in 45, I don't think Truman had any particular problem with Franco. Eisenhower, I know, certainly didn't have any problem with him. FDR hated him violently, but after the war, that was irrelevant. And Franco went about rebuilding Spanish society. Now, there's a lot of stuff out there on the Civil War in Spain, on Franco as a man, and Franco as a military man, strategist, as a speaker, as an ideologue. But there isn't a whole lot on how he ran the Spanish economy in the 50s and 60s. And I think one reason for that is that the Spanish economy took off. It took off under the social nationalist and corporatist regime of Franco, and became one of the world's most powerful economies, only to revert to third world status upon Franco's death, and the socialists took over and essentially ran it into the ground. But we're going to take a break right now, and when we come back, my purpose is going to be to get into some detail as to how Franco ran the Spanish economy in the 50s and 60s. But more specifically, I really want to get into how the sort of national corporatism, social nationalism, this kind of this vision of Franco, which was his interpretation of Catholic and Christian economics, actually worked out in practice. So hang in there. We'll be right back.
Don't go away, because there's more to come on The Orthodox Nationalist. You're listening to the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network. Visit us at reasonradionetwork.com. Let's return to The Orthodox Nationalist, brought to you by the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network, reasonradionetwork.com.
Okay, everybody, welcome back to The Orthodox Nationalist. Today we are dealing with something we don't normally deal with here, but something that's been of interest to me for a while, and that's Francisco Franco and the nature of his rule after World War II. That is to say, the Spanish social and economic system in the 1950s and 1960s. And here you have a long-term experiment in social nationalist and corporatist thinking and action. And I want to say that it was a tremendous success. And Franco, even under Western sanctions, I think I misspoke before the break. I think that Franco was not liked, but he was tolerated. But this did not prevent the Americans and the British very arrogantly placing sanctions on Spain after the war, because Franco, in their mind, was a fascist and therefore needed to be destroyed. But as is occasionally the case with sanctions, not only did it not harm Franco's Spain, but because of the nature of the internal corporatist structure of the economy, it actually assisted Spain. And Spain, after the war, had reached full employment for a lot of the reasons that you saw in South Africa in the 1970s, because sanctions forced the state to take a certain control over the economy and then work towards creating autarky, the idea of national self-sufficiency in terms of economics. And what this did in South Africa in the 70s and Franco's Spain in the late 40s and 50s is it brought Spain to full employment. It boosted the government, it boosted the military, and it boosted the economy. And so by 1950, Spain was well on its way to being an autarkic social nationalist state. Now, in 1953, the so-called Pact of Madrid was signed, and this pact lifted sanctions, and because Franco clearly was not going anywhere, he has now been ruling from 1939 to 1953, He still remains fairly popular. The West is very, very upset, explicitly so, that these leftists are still in prison. Remember, Stalin is still Uncle Joe now, despite the Korean War. And there's still substantial support for Stalin in America and in Western Europe, at least in part due to the war and part due to ideology. But Stalin is ailing and dies in 1953, and maybe it's not an accident that the Pact of Madrid is signed as Stalin is ailing. And the Pact of Madrid permits Franco to sort of retroactively take part in the Marshall Plan, and there's even some officer training. And from 1955 onward, trade is opened with the West, and the social nationalist system of Spain begins to take off. What a lot of people don't know or don't remember is that Franco's social nationalist system, this corporatist structure of the economy, was by the late 50s called the Spanish Miracle. Franco's economy, by all accounts, grew at the same rate as Japan's after World War II. Francisco Franco was, by his own admission, ignorant about a lot of economic matters. He was a military man. He was a religious man. But when it came to economics, he didn't have the confidence. And righteously so. I mean, he was no economist. And so he brought in foreign advisors from both America, Britain, as well as the continent to assist Spain in economic planning. I mean, here you have a non-Marxist form of economic planning under the military government that, in fact, took off. By the end of the 1950s, Spain was the ninth largest economy in the world. As I said, it had the growth rate the same as Japan in this period of time, with tremendous strides in not only incomes for business, but also wages and personal income and disposable income. Autarky was abandoned because it really wasn't necessary anymore, and yet we have to make it clear that the libertarians are absolutely wrong on this stuff. They're wrong. The Spanish state controlled the economy in one form or another under the military regime of Franco. It had this national corporatist underpinning, sort of a social nationalist vision of economics, that grew quicker almost than any other country on the planet in the 1950s. You see, you had this period of time after the war where Spain was forced to build everything from the ground up. Now, in this case, the state was necessary. The state had to maintain labor discipline for such an undertaking. And it was mobilizing resources. So in that sense, the state was creating wealth. So you had this fully Spanish economy that was protected because of these stupid sanctions starting in 1945-46. But by the Pact of Madrid in 1953, the Spanish economy was clearly first world and was ready to compete with pretty much anybody on their own terms. The state sponsored growth, the state underwrote and financed industry, and contra what the libertarians say, the Spanish economy was growing at a rate between 10 and 15% a year. That fact blows away all the libertarian nonsense. Now, maybe the libertarians are right in an advanced economy with a lot of room for growth and a lot of room for entrepreneurship. In that case, the libertarian argument is probably solid to a great extent. At least I can understand it. I might not agree with it, but I understand it. But when you have a war-torn economy under assault from all sides, as Franco was faced with after 1945, there is no room for that kind of libertarian world and view. The state had to protect the country from attack from the outside, both economically and politically. And the fact that the social nationalist system of Franco was sponsored by the state, underwritten by the state, and in fact, industry was built by the state, that did not prevent Spain from building their own automobile. It was called the Seat Car, S-E-A-T, and it was a joint venture between Madrid on the one hand and Fiat on the other hand. Now, the advisors that Franco had brought in from a good portion of the world to assist him in his economic development, they had advised him pretty intelligently, and they said, it appears that Spain has a comparative advantage in automotives. Clearly, Japan was showing this to some extent at the time. But in Spain, the Spanish automotive industry was growing just as fast as the Japanese. In the 1950s, the automotive sector, not just cars, but also engines and spare parts and everything from axles to the paint, was growing at a rate of 21.7%. This is the case throughout the 1950s and 1960s. That was the average growth of the automotive sector, and Spain had its own brand of car, which unthinkable today, actually existed and sold fairly well in Europe back in the 1950s. Unfortunately, as Franco grew older and more frail, the decentralist mentality, I think, had taken over. And in 1973, when the oil crisis hit the West, thanks to U.S. support for Israel, that kind of ended the Spanish miracle. And that actually ended, it destroyed economies all over the place. That the oil price shock starting in 1973 really shocked a lot of places. I think Spain was slightly more insulated because of the strong state that was able to protect the economy. But by 1973, Franco's rule was at least de facto at an end, although not yet de jure. Franco died a couple of years later. And then everything sort of fell apart from there. And I think that the 73 oil shock put the Spanish government and Spanish economy, which up until that point had been not only healthy but absolutely dominant in terms of production and growth per year. And then we also have very good figures in terms of wages and cost and the economic standard of living. Measured in dollars and cents, measured in dollars, and in adjusted for inflation, you had an average of between 10% and 15% GDP growth every year. And I want to repeat that the main reason for this is the period of autarky after the war created a highly competitive, stable, economic foundation, so that when the Pact of Madrid was signed in 1953, it then presented this brand new, never before seen Spanish economic powerhouse to the world, and then was capable of trading with anyone and everyone. The automotive sector in Spain was extremely competitive and drew investment all over Europe, from all over Europe. Although off the top of my head, I don't know about the Japanese. But however you slice it, the Spanish economy was an advanced first world economy, especially in the second, the growth rates in the second half of the 1950s and the tremendous growth rates in the 1960s. I want to say that, and my thesis here, as I've said before, is that Franco is not just a military figure. For those of us who are anti-communist, for any normal human being who finds the slaughter of clergy, you know, apolitical clergy to a great extent, in the 1930s under the Republican government, absolutely repugnant. For any normal human being, Franco government was infinitely more humane. Franco and the economy, they were doing so well in the 1960s, and he was so popular because of this economic success, that he declared amnesty to all the left-wing prisoners that had been in prison since the war. The only people who were not allowed out were those who actually committed crimes against humanity, you know, summary executions, that kind of thing. But those who were there because they were involved in the communist movement, although were not criminals, they were released. And that shows a tremendous amount of security from the Spanish point of view, and the fact that we have proven through this social nationalist system that we can bypass both Marxism and laissez-faire capitalism and then still modernize to first world status and still be a modern economy. And a modern economy and a first world economy with education in the hands of the church, which is something that Franco did. The church was given education as its primary area of social activism, and that education was sufficient to create a workforce that was increasingly sophisticated and literate in modern economic work. All of this should give a lot of people pause. Even the massive success of the country socially and economically on the one side, and the statist social nationalist vision of the economy and corporatism and the syndicates on the other side. But Franco, for 20 years, 50s and 60s, is capable of creating a first world economy without falling into the extremes of either laissez-faire capitalism on the one side, so to speak, and, of course, Marxism on the other side. And Franco was part of a generation, really the same generation that brought Primo de Rivera to power. You know, this idea that parliaments don't do anything. Parliaments have no control over the economy. Parliaments are controlled by the economy. They're financed by elite economic actors. They have no power over the economy. And, you know, Franco was part of this generation that didn't take parliaments very seriously. People are no happier under parliamentary government than they are under military rule. It just depends on context. Spain, in the 50s and 60s, was not a totalitarian state in the sense that the Soviet Union and the Warsaw Pact were totalitarian states. Political power was devolved to some extent in this era to civic assemblies. These were local, essentially local trade union organizations that got together in regular intervals and decided, at least on the major issues of common Spanish policy, and that these also were empowered to negotiate with the major capitalists, that is to say, privately owned enterprises in Spain, in terms of putting together reasonable and rational labor contracts. The so-called vertical syndicate was the national trade union, and the national trade union was charged by the military with cooperation between owners on the one hand and workers on the other. And what a lot of people don't know, and what has been censored from history books, was that workers at the shop level were able to elect plant representatives to argue their case to management. Now, it is true that Franco, at least for this period of time, had banned strikes. However, in exchange for labor accepting a ban on strikes, he guaranteed jobs to any Spanish citizen who needed it. So that was the contract. So Franco's idea was that I will guarantee an economic livelihood for my citizens. I will provide all of these freedoms for workers on the shop floor and the representation in the national union, but of course they also can elect representatives at the local level, even at the shop level. But, and I'll do all that in exchange for you guys not striking. Don't think of this as some, you know, as the left always did, as this, you know, anti-labor thing. Franco was pro-labor. His policy was pro-labor, clearly. But strikes for somebody from Franco's generation, 20s and 30s, strikes meant the death of the society. Remember this. It's not like today. We wish labor unions would strike more to gain the fair share of labor, which right now is going to CEOs and the major players in the economy. Franco's generation was different. Strikes were something that the communists and the anarchists had organized, not because they cared about workers. Under the Republic, wages did not go up in any substantial way. They went up only under Franco. But they were done to destabilize and destroy companies, the economy, the state, local governments, and the Catholic world in Spain. That's what strikes meant for somebody growing up in the 1920s and 1930s, coming of age in the 1930s. Strikes had nothing to do, somebody growing up in that generation, strikes had nothing to do with improving the lot of workers. Strikes were a political means of taking power, even if that taking power really had nothing to do with labor at all. And the Republican government had nothing, no particular interest in labor, no more than the Soviet Union had any interest in labor. The Soviet Union ruthlessly exploited its workers, infinitely worse than any capitalist society. And this is what a lot of people in Western Europe were thinking. Yeah, the communists were absurdities. They were ruthless in their exploitation. Yet at the same time, we cannot accept the oligarchic implications of laissez-faire capitalism. So keep that, you know, when you read about Francisco Franco and you see all of his actions against striking workers, remember the context here. You grew up in the 1920s in Spain where every other day was a new strike and the economy was going backwards and even basic necessities were unavailable because of the political nature and the destructive nature of these strikes. Franco would not countenance them. However, in return, he gave labor many, many freedoms that did not exist in Great Britain or in the United States. Now, there were political parties and factions in Spanish life, much like in the Western world. They had to be approved by the system. You know, every so-called free society in the West only countenances political parties that are pro-system. If you're anti-system, you're not allowed to function. It's that simple. And in Spain, it was no different. Yeah, but, you know, at least in the Spanish case, the system was genuinely popular. The so-called families that existed in Franco's Spain represented different elements of what we would call, for lack of a better phrase, the right wing. And these families existed, this family is a metaphor, of course, they're not actual families. These families represent different factions of the right wing. And we see it even on our own Voice of Reason network. You have monarchists, you have religious traditionalists of different kinds, you have those interested in economics, the syndicalists, the social nationalists, you had military elements, and then you had the clerical elements. And Franco viewed his job as sort of a regent, a quasi-monarch, whose purpose was to balance off these different factions. And I should note, I should have noted this before, but in 1953, the same year the Pact of Madrid was signed, Franco had finally put together his concordat with the Vatican. I want to make clear something about the Church of Rome. I even want to call Franco an old Catholic rather than a Roman Catholic, because it took almost 20 years for the Vatican to come to recognize Franco. Now, think about that for a minute. That when I first read that years ago, It took years for me to figure out how that could possibly work. Um, Francisco Franco was a man who campaigned both politically and militarily as a Roman Catholic soldier. Now, the Church of Rome knew, of course, everyone knew, in the 1930s what the Republicans were doing to the clergy. And then, of course, banned the clerical orders altogether prior to the Civil War breaking out. One of the last straws, especially in a country like Spain. To ban the Catholic religious order seems absurd, but it shows you the nature of the Republic and what the left really is in Western European life. But the Vatican refused to recognize Franco. It refused to recognize Franco throughout the Civil War. It refused to recognize Franco throughout World War II. It joined with the Allies in putting sanctions, in the Vatican's case, you know, symbolic, sanctions on Spain until 1953. And only when the Allies lifted the blockade on Spain, at the same time, the Vatican lifted its spiritual blockade on Spain. In the meantime, Franco was largely choosing his own bishops. He was afraid that some modernist liberal may slip in there. That movement was long since afoot in the Vatican. And I think that Franco did not trust the Vatican in the same way that the Vatican did not trust Franco. And in 1953, the Vatican and General Franco had come to an agreement where bishops would be appointed by the Vatican, but only at the approval of Franco. Again, the purpose being that he was afraid of several things. He was afraid of Masonic penetration into the Vatican. He was afraid of modernist infiltration into the Vatican. He was afraid of homosexual activists in the Vatican, something that has come home to roost for a lot of Roman Catholics, most unfortunately. Franco, I think, was more wise as to what was happening in the Vatican in the 1950s, late 1940s, than he's normally given credit for. So it took a long time. From 1936 to 1953 for the Vatican to finally come around and recognize the leader who saved God knows how many Catholics, clergy and otherwise, from the clutches of the Stalinist republic. And you've really got to shake your head here of what in the heck, and this is the pre-Vatican II Vatican bureaucracy we're talking about here, refusing to recognize Franco only unless the other allies, that is to say the coalition against Hitler in World War II, not including the Soviet Union, of course, recognized Franco. And all of that took place as Stalin was either dying or dead in 1953. There's something else before I wrap up today. There's three separate laws that, while occasionally you find them in biographies of Franco and histories of Spain and the period, they're generally nowhere to be found in the public consciousness, even among Spanish-speaking people. In 1949, Franco put to the vote of the nation the so-called law of succession. Now remember, this is prior to Vatican recognition of Franco. The law of succession was a referendum that said that Spain will be ruled by a Catholic social, that is to say social nationalist, and representative, that is genuinely populist, monarchy. Now, until a suitable candidate could be found, which was a big issue, by the way, Franco would remain as regent. And of course, when Franco dies in 1975, Juan Carlos fills, very, very poorly, by the way, fills that gap. the region had died. 88% of the Spanish population in 1949 voted yes to that, thereby showing that Franco was not merely a military leader, but in fact was an elected politician. The Law on Principles, also passed in a referendum in 1958, justified and popularized the basic principles of the social nationalist system. And the Organic Law in 1966, which essentially was a version of a constitution that gave a lot of power and freedom of action to the prime minister. And there's no accident, this is in 1966, Franco is getting old. And not only is he getting old, but the Spanish economy is doing very, very well. He has nothing to fear, nothing frightened Franco, if for no other reason than he was amazingly successful. And it should be noted that the statist systems in Latin America were failing wretchedly at the same time that Franco's system in Spain was taking off. And that's a curious issue. You had military governments all over the place in Latin America who couldn't do a damn thing right. And here, Franco, with a fairly well-organized, well-thought-out social system, is becoming one of the dominant economies in the world. So I want to thank you guys for listening. I appreciate all of your feedback. I want to thank everyone at the Voice of Reason. Thank you, guys. God bless, and I'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening. The Orthodox Nationalist returns Thursday evening, 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Tuned into Radio Ariane.